Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 14 years of law enforcement analysis experience. He's a certified law enforcement analyst with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, a certified geographic profile analyst, and a gang specialist. He is currently the technology director for the Florida Crime and Intelligence Analysts Association. He has several publications on the security concerns of sovereign citizens, and he is currently working on his PhD. We're actually together live at the FCIAA conference in Orlando. So please welcome Tommy Smith. Tommy, how are we doing?
Hey, good. How are you?
Very good. So this is our first podcast live doing face-to-face. So it's nice to be here in Orlando. And I definitely want to get over several topics with you. But let's first talk about how you discovered the law enforcement analysis profession.
So it was kind of by accident. I was working for the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office down in a little town called Monticello, Florida, just outside Tallahassee. And I had been there for a little over 5 years starting communications, and then I kind of took over the unofficial role of the assistant communications supervisor. And then I just, like I always do, volunteer myself for more work and started taking over doing the processing of the warrants, and eventually got them cleared out. Got a bunch of them cleared and served or no info that were too old and the statute of limitations expired. So then I was kind of looking for something else to do, and I was going to school. I started my bachelor's degree, and I said, well, I really need to put this to use, and I knew I couldn't really move up there. And so I just was casually browsing, and I found an ad for a crime analyst at Tallahassee Police Department. So I said, you know, what the hey? I applied for it. Didn't expect anything out of it because I really didn't know what it was. And a couple weeks later, I get a call from the supervisor there at the Tallahassee PD asking me to come in for an interview. So I came in for the initial interview, and they liked me, and they called me back for a second interview. And that one went all whipped with the captain. And then a couple weeks after that, I got hired doing my first job as a crime analyst with Tallahassee PD. And I've been doing that ever since. And that was in 2012.
Okay. Well, very good. I like the tenacity. I like the go-getter. That opens up some doors. And when you volunteer, look to get stuff improved, and that opportunities will come in. So then you're new to the field, you're coming in, I guess, what were some initial setbacks or lessons learned as you think back at the beginning days in Tallahassee?
So one of my biggest concerns when I first started, and actually this kind of was started in the test that we had to take during the interview process, was Microsoft Excel. Mm-hmm. Working at the Jefferson County, I really had no experience in the advanced operations of Excel, and I didn't know what a pivot table was. Mm-hmm. And I actually had computerized our warrant log and made it in Excel format, but it was just basic. So I really had to learn that, and I taught myself pretty quickly. And then the other concern was the GIS. Other than the 911 system and the phase one and phase two hits on that for geolocating a 911 caller, I really had no experience in GIS at the time. So I had to learn that, but luckily I had, her name's Annie Thompson, mm-hmm. who used to be the supervisor there, and she's the one who hired me.
Yeah, we had her on the show.
And so she was a big inspiration, and she was a big help. I actually attest to her skill, and she's probably the one of the biggest influencers to me keeping on in the crime analysis field and helping me get acquainted with what a crime analyst does and training me in GIS. And I mean, she taught me some tricks in Excel, and then after that I just kind of took over and taught myself. But she's one of the that really helped me overcome some huge hurdles, and she's the inspiration behind me continuing on to go for the PhD.
Okay, and we'll get to that. I want to talk about the PhD. When you're in Tallahassee, then what kind of tasks are you doing? What are you asked to do at this time?
So it's a little bit different coming from a PD at Tallahassee and then to now the Leon County Sheriff's Office. So it's two sides of the same coin, but it's like night and day going from blue to green. And so at the police department, we were primarily statistics driven. And so we were pure crime analysts there. We did just the mapping. We did public records requests for anything of a statistical nature or location-based request for crime stats. And we also fulfilled some requests for the media, and then other requests for attorneys. And then we got subpoenaed sometimes, but very rarely. Now at the Leon County Sheriff's Office, it's more of a mix of crime analysis and intel and investigative analysis. So even though my specialty now is the GIS and crime mapping and pattern analysis, we also all pitch in and we help with the corrections analysis, gang tracking, general intel analysis, intel bulletins, person identification, and things like that. So it's a good mix there. And so that's why I tell people it's like night and day when I transitioned from that agency to LCSO.
Okay, so at the time, how many analysts were there in Tallahassee?
So when I first started at TBD, we had two analysts, me and one other full-time, and then Annie, the supervisor. Then when I went to Leon County Sheriff's Office, I think when I started, we had five analysts plus the supervisor. And now, over the past 3 years, we now have 17 positions, and that includes our real-time crime center and our criminal intelligence and analysis unit, part-time and full-time personnel.
Okay. Let's talk about the transition then from Tallahassee PD to Leon County. Just talk about your thought process, why you made that transition, and looking back, some of the lessons learned.
So there were some organizational changes that going on at Tallahassee PD that we kind of split up the unit. Now, by we, I mean the agency. I obviously wasn't our choice, but so it kind of split up the unit, and we were housed in different locations, and it just wasn't as cohesive as it used to be. And then Annie, the previous supervisor, she'd retired, and then she took a position at another agency up north. And so that kind of just made the whole mechanism just different. And so I said, well, I really want to be in a unit together that's working more cohesively. So I was actually talked on the phone with Leslie Raven with the Sheriff's Office at Leon County, and she had called me for some assistance with something, and I was just helping her, and she's like, hey, what are you doing? And I said, I was just sitting here writing a code for GIS. And she goes, oh, you can code? I said, yeah. She said, well, how much would it take me to get you over here? So we just kind of talked for a little while, and then it was coming up on the new fiscal year, and they were getting approval for two senior analyst positions. And so when that came open, I kind of discussed it with Annie, as a matter of fact, because we still keep in touch to the day. And she's like, I think it would be a good move for you. I think there's a lot of opportunity over there to move up since they're expanding. And so I went ahead and I applied for it, interviewed, and got the job, and I've been there ever since.
Okay. So it seems like from what I'm hearing from you, you started in at Tallahassee PD, not knowing a lot of the programs, but you really start to develop your technical skills.
Right.
And you get into coding, you get into data manipulation, data management, because that's, I'm guessing, is what's needed as you're doing all these reports, because you're trying to, as analysts,
correct,
we're always
yeah.
trying to automate as much as possible. So did you learn the coding on your own, or did you take a class?
I learned it on my own, and so I'm not an expert at it, and so I'm careful always to say that so people don't throw work my way for coding.
Yeah.
I was like, hold on, I'm not an expert. I just know how to get by.
Yeah.
And so most of what I know is SQL based,
sure,
and especially the SQL expressions for ArcMap.
Okay.
And then now I'm slowly teaching myself Arcade with the new ArcGIS Pro. So that's an ongoing process. And but yeah, I pretty much learned the coding on my own. And now back in the day, I'm gonna tell my age a little bit here. Mm-hmm. When MySpace was a thing and a website called My Yearbook, it was kind of another social media platform before Facebook came along. You could modify your page and fully customize it with HTML coding. So I actually learned and taught myself HTML coding with those websites. And then SQL came along. And then when I started doing the tech director job with the FCIAA, that's when I taught myself how to do all the different coding on WordPress, which I'm still not an expert, but I do a pretty good job.
So then for the mapping and the coding, is the reason you're doing that so you can schedule jobs and have all the data manipulation manually and push out data? Is that the purpose that you normally use coding for when you're doing the mapping?
So most of it is because when, and this is, it's kind of an awkward spot because TBD had a full-time public safety coordinator in their GIS, on their GIS side, mm-hmm. that worked. He assists the county too, but it was mostly mm-hmm. for city. And so he built custom maps, custom scheduled jobs and everything, and had access directly to the server. So LCSO's crime analysis function was kind of brand new, and they hadn't had the ArcGIS products that long. Mm-hmm. And so when I came there, there was not a lot of automation going on with the mapping part. So I had to build in some things, and there was also not a lot of saved queries for specific things. Like at TBD, we had where we could, what we called tracked crime, mm-hmm. quote unquote. And that included your burglaries and robberies and what the, some sexual batteries and what the agency wanted to concentrate on at the time. Mm-hmm. LCSO didn't have that. They had just lists of dispositions, lists of crime types, and you had to go ahead and select the different ones. So most of the coding I've done is for specific types of queries. So we can just go in there and run those, or I even have some of them saved on the server, so we could just copy and paste them in and run them, so you don't have to go select all these dispositions and everything. And so that's the main goal of my coding there at the agency, not so much of the automation, because I'm one of those people that likes to go in and clean the data, mm-hmm. and I just don't trust it to go out automatically without me looking at it first. Now, our public records are mostly handled by our records department, so that's not an issue for us, whereas I had to, you know, schedule jobs to be sent out as public records requests, mm-hmm. unlike TBD, where we did do that, and we had automated reports that would go out for them, just, you know, general reports with block ranges, not exact street addresses, and an accompanying map. But here at LCSO, the records department handles the brunt of it, so we don't have a need for like specific automation for that.
So it's always a good tip to reach out to somebody that knows the program that you're trying to learn. So you're learning coding with the mapping, reaching out to your planning department, and reaching out to, as you mentioned, somebody who's already doing it.
Right.
Besides that, do you have any tips for maybe an analyst that's looking to get into coding and mapping?
Yes, yeah, so I would definitely check with your local GIS department if you have one. But I mean, they are excellent, because that's who I work with now a lot to get a lot of my stuff done, mm-hmm. is our local, we call it interlocal, and it's Tallahassee-Leon County GIS. Well, shout out to them, because they've really been helping me over the past year, mm-hmm. even through COVID. So they're pretty excellent with all forms of coding. I mean, SQL, Arcade, pretty much everything you can think of, Python scripts. Python scripts are very challenging. And another person that I would definitely recommend is Lori Velarde. She's a GIS analyst with the city of Irvine. I think she's still with them in California. And she does the geographic profiling training, and she's pretty much the bomb when it comes to Python scripting. And she does a ton of automation between ArcMap and programs like Microsoft Access to schedule different jobs and categorize different types of crime and create pattern identifiers and stuff. So she actually came to our agency and helped us with some of our reporting. And so she's very knowledgeable, and she left some Python scripts with me.
All right, great. That's good advice. So let's get into you moving on to Leon County. And which, for those that don't know, Leon County is the county that houses Tallahassee.
Right.
So as you move over, you get into intelligence, as you mentioned, you get more into task force intelligence analyst. So how was that transition going from a crime analysis role to now having more of an intelligence role?
So in a way, on one side, it was exciting because I'd really never done that part of it before, because at Tallahassee PD, we had civilian crime analysts, and then we had a couple investigators that were assigned as intel investigators that handled all the intel bulletins and all that case assistance. And so, I mean, it was pretty fun when it first started, and then I quickly realized that it was a whole different ball game. Like, I didn't know all the rules for intel, and we didn't have to be 28 CFR certified at TPD, whereas with LCSO we do. Mm-hmm. So took that class, got the, you know, certification every year, and so it was definitely a learning curve. But at the end of the day, it just basically falls on networking with the detectives and the deputies, because crime analysts are more geared at a lot of departments towards patrol. And you might not have necessarily as much direct contact with people on the road as an intel or an investigative analyst would have with detectives. And so that's something that I had to learn to do, is start coming out of the shell a little bit more and speaking with the detectives in the different units. And I still don't do it as much, just because now I supervise the crime analysis function and then help the intelligence manager supervise the entire intelligence section. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a whole lot of free time to do the intel side of it, but mm-hmm. I mean, we all handle bulletins and requests that come in our help box, so we all pitch in and help there. But yeah, it was definitely a learning curve coming over.
Okay. So what are maybe some special projects you worked on, or maybe some of the issues that you're trying to tackle with the county?
So right now, the most recent and the biggest one is they wanted to start, and this came from all the way up, they wanted to start what's called prescriptive policing. Mm-hmm. And that kind of takes on a combination of intel-led policing with proactive, your standard proactive policing mm-hmm. at agencies. And it's just saying, okay, well, here's your neighborhood or your area with the most crime. So what specifically can we do to address the crime in this area, and what has worked well in the past that mm-hmm. might work well in the future? Mm-hmm. And instead of just saying, okay, well, here's the hot spot, so we need to go be proactive in these areas mm-hmm. without knowing specifics. So they wanted to start that, so I suggested, and actually Leslie at the Sheriff's Office also suggested along with me to our chain that we need to start with a smaller area, because it's something new to us, we've never done before, and there's only a few of us doing the crime analysis portion mm-hmm. of the work, so it would make sense to start with a smaller area. So we decided to do a neighborhood pilot, and so we've been working on collecting data for that. And so that consisted of a general hotspot analysis of the calls for service for both Leon County Sheriff's Office and Tallahassee Police Department to figure out what are the hot spots for particular types of crime. And then we actually went out with some sworn personnel and canvassed the neighborhood and went to these spots. And this is where the GIS department came in from our county group, and they actually helped me build a risk assessment map. And so we went out with the iPad to all these different areas. We went once during the day, and then we went once at night, and that way we could record all the things that might be crime generators or crime facilitators in the area, like your dilapidated housing, open bars that are 24 hours a day or open, you know, really, really early in the morning. Mm-hmm. And then bad fencing, no fencing, mm-hmm. tree lines that could be concealing, low lighting, which could only be observed after dark. And so once we did that, certain things like that are attributed to certain types of crime, like the wooded areas may be more appropriate for like your person's crimes mm-hmm. where people could jump you while you're walking. Low lighting could be anything from vehicle burglaries to peeping Toms, whereas the vehicle burglaries, they break the window or they open the door and you can't really see their face because it's too dark. And so the map, after we are done with it, it actually gives us a rating for each area as to what crime type is most likely to occur there. And then the next step is to do the time and day analysis for the current incidents. And then that way we can direct our patrols, and then we can also partner with the community. And that's our next big goal, is to see what kind of partnerships we can forge with the community and partner organizations to say, okay, well, there's no lighting here. Can we put up a light pole? Or there's dilapidated housing over here that's been vacant and just, you know, raggedy for a year or more. Can we do something? Can we use code enforcement? Can we tear it down, get rid of it, restore it, and anything like that to clear out some of those crime generators and crime facilitators that law enforcement can't necessarily rectify on our own?
Okay, so it seems like you're getting into crime prevention, so that gets into SEPTED.
Right.
Crime prevention through environmental design. You're getting into problem solving. And I'm curious about this concept of prescriptive policing. So how does prescriptive policing differ from problem solving or SEPTED or even intelligence-led policing?
So a lot of it is it's the same concept, and I think it's kind of a new take on it, just a new name that they've come up with. And the problem that we found is we reached out to a lot of different places. I mean, I've sent things out on the IACA forums, and I've sent some things out to our local FCIAA listserv, and then one other person on the project team has sent something out to maybe an IACP or one of his groups, and there's really no feedback as to what other agencies are doing with prescriptive policing. There's been a lot of talk about it, but not a lot of action and not a lot of literature out there that agencies have actually recorded. So I'm curious to know if any other agencies are actually, that are listening, are actually trying that concept and had success with it. So and we've kind of altered it a little bit. We've kind of gone a different way, because most of it is where you would analyze your historical crime and you analyze your current crime trends and say, and this is kind of the problem-oriented policing, is you say, all right, well, here's the most community contacts in this area, the most violent crimes in this area, and then there's really no data, and then they patrol based on that. But the difference is with prescriptive policing, we want to know exactly what worked in the past. Mm-hmm. But with data limitations, like in your CAD data, even in your RMS data, at most agencies, it's not built to where an officer goes in and puts the exact thing that helped in that area. Mm-hmm. They use dispositions to close cases that say, okay, arrest was made, or FIR written, or the call was canceled, or contact made, you know, no prosecution, whatever. But there's nothing to say, okay, well, we patrolled for 10 minutes in this area and we handed out some flyers, and that is probably what, you know, made the crime go down in this area or dispersed it to this other area over here. So that's the biggest difference that I see in the method that we're trying to employ versus the existing ones, is trying to combat it directly and then forging those community partnerships as well, which, and I mean, a lot of agencies try it, but it's just not as successful because you have to get that buy-in from all the way up, which we have it, but you also have to get the buy-in from those community partners, and you have to make sure you have the trust of the county, the trust of the city, and your citizens, because those neighborhood watch groups are a huge part of it too. And if you don't have that, then you're probably not going to be as successful as you could be with the program.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think it's interesting that we have just this new concept. It's very new, and does seem like there's a lot of overlap with problem solving. It's just what you were describing.
Right.
It seems like a lot of like problem solving. So I'll be curious to know, as this prescriptive policing takes off, to see how it branches off different from problem solving.
Yeah, and it's something we definitely want to explore. Like right now, we're still in the not the infancy stages, but probably the middle stages of getting the plan together. And then after that, the goal is to go in the neighborhoods and produce a wellness report, mm-hmm. and that's what we're going to call it because it prescriptive, prescription, mm-hmm. wellness, a neighborhood wellness report that encompasses the crime in the crime in the area, what we're doing to be proactive mm-hmm. or reactive for said crime, what community stuff that we've done, and any citizen contacts. And then I think there was some talk about going out and actually surveying the residents of the community. Mm-hmm. And so that's all going to go in this weekly report so we can address it from week to week mm-hmm. and set a goal as to, okay, well, here's the amount of crime, the percentage of crime that we want to reduce in this area. And then once we reduce it and we stay in it for, you know, 6 months in this particular pilot neighborhood, if we can meet that goal or exceed that goal, then we can move to the next neighborhood and run the same program. And so if it works and if we're successful, it's something that we had talked about actually publishing for other departments to follow along or adopt a similar strategy.
Just one last question regarding the county then. So you then move from an analyst to a supervisor.
Right.
And so how did you like that transition, going from analyst to supervisor?
So I still consider myself an analyst mm-hmm. because I still do, you know, the groundwork. But it was a little bit different. I'd been doing quasi-supervision for a little over a year because I had one part-time employee. And so what had happened was our current intelligence manager got a well-deserved promotion to an executive director of our youth services department. So that created some availability in the section. And because we have so many people, it was decided to go ahead and promote two people. So Chelsea is our intelligence manager, Chelsea Grant, and so she took the intelligence manager spot, and then I was promoted to the supervisory analyst over crime analysis. And then when she needs assistance, I assist in supervising the whole intelligence section. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a different ball game once I got to that level, because now not only am I responsible for what I do, but also responsible for what the other people under me do. And then now, whenever Chelsea goes out of town mm-hmm. or is unavailable, if there's a major development or something like that, I get stuck with it.
Yeah.
So, but no, it's all good. Mm-hmm. But we have a really good group of people.
How many analysts do you have total?
So just doing crime analysis, we have, including myself, there's four.
Mm-hmm.
And then the whole intelligence section, which includes crime analysis, intel analysis, our fusion analyst, and for North Florida Fusion Exchange, and our real-time crime center, we have a total of 16 mm-hmm. Filled positions and then one vacancy for mm-hmm. a part-time position. So we've grown a lot over the past 3 years, from 5 to 17.
And this is a centralized model, right?
Right.
Instead of dispersed. And it sounds like you support the centralized model as opposed to spreading people out.
Yeah. Well, the main reason for that is just the structure of our city and county. And it's because we're not huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're mid-sized, but we're not anything like, you know, Miami-Dade or New York City. Whereas those would support that because they have all the different substations and different specialty units that are located elsewhere. But with us, we have no real true substations. And the department, the building itself is not huge. So we share intel better and we share crime analysis information better mm-hmm. when we're centralized, because if somebody was working in a different bureau or a different department, and you've got somebody, say an investigation, somebody in law enforcement, we know that when a patrol officer is out with somebody, a detective might have had contact with them earlier and might have case notes that's not in the system. And you're working with this detective, the other analyst is working with this officer, and if you're not there together and you know, you're talking on the phone with somebody in the same office and you're saying, oh, well, so-and-so's out with John Doe. Oh, my detective was working with John Doe last week. And he said, if you had any contact with him, then we need to pick him up because he's been doing this too long. We need to get him off the street, or we need to bring him in for an interview or something like that. So it's real easy to share intel, and very little makes it through the cracks with our unit just because we're centralized and we work well together. And even during COVID, we do meetings weekly over Zoom or in person, whatever the mechanism is at the time. And we talk on the phone, we have email groups. So we're always sharing information. And then we have our weekly intelligence sharing meeting that includes our CIB and some representatives from patrol. So I think it just depends on your agency size and the makeup of your city and your county as to, does the centralized version work better for you, or does the decentralized version work better for you? And it also comes down to the placement of the unit, whether you're under law enforcement, under investigations, under administration, or whatever. And I think that's also dependent upon the structure of your agency and your locale.
All right, well, let's take a break. When we come back, I do want to get to your badge story, your analyst badge story. I want to talk about sovereign citizens and, of course, FCIAA.
Okay.
And then we'll talk about you as a model and actor.
All right.
You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
This is Erin Wickersham from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, and my public service announcement is to go on a court along. You may have been on a ride along, and I think someone else recommended a 911 operator sit along. So find a prosecutor in your jurisdiction and see if you can go to court with them. You'll learn a lot about the process and about the work that they're doing.
You didn't do the dishes?
Well, no, I was busy doing other chores. But my completed chores is up 5 in the last 7 days.
Yeah, but you're still down 13 over the last 28 days.
Well, I see your shopping purchases is up 20% this month.
My spending is still down year to date. In fact, my black shoe purchases are half of what they were this time last year.
Well, thank goodness last year wasn't a normal year.
Plus, I bought you new underwear, so your clothes purchases is up 40% this month compared to last month.
Oh, wait. There were no clothes purchases the previous month, Miss Perfect. I didn't know you had the ability to divide by zero.
You should be happy. Your temperature-led policing program has worked great in this house. I have not touched your precious thermostat in the last 6 months.
Hi, this is Dawn Colossius. I just want you to know that when you hear or you think as an analyst, they don't know what they want us to do. Always remember, you don't have to wait. Show them, tell them, and be value added.
Welcome back. Tommy, now I want to get into your analyst badge story. And for those that may be new to the show, the analyst badge story is the career-defining case or project that an analyst worked on. And for you, it goes, you know, as you first started with Tallahassee Police Department involving scooter thefts.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about that.
So it's more funny than exciting, but so I had just started, I think it was my first week, and I was just learning how to run data in ArcMap from the records management system and the computer aided dispatcher CAD. And I was looking at a bunch of cases that I exported into Excel, because we would export and analyze everything for patterns. And I was just learning how to put all this stuff in our, what we called our workbooks for our tracked crimes. And I just happened to see a few things that had TAO, and I always pronounce it TAO. I'm not really sure what the correct pronunciation is, but it's a brand of scooter. And I saw these being stolen. And so I went to Annie, my supervisor, and I said, hey, I just noticed these three things, these three scooters that were stolen, and there's no real color pattern. You know, one was blue, one was red, one was something else, but it's all the same brand, and it's all, you know, nearby on the map. And she goes, oh, you know what? good eye. We got something for a bulletin now. And she said, I don't think I've ever had anybody put a bulletin out in their first couple of days, so you're going to be the first. So we ended up getting the bulletin together, crime pattern bulletin, put it together, got it sent out. Then we started getting hit with more and more scooters. So I really got thrown into it and had to acquaint myself with bulletin updates and then how to add the new information to the map after I save, because with anybody that's ever worked in ArcMap, you can't just save and save and save and it doesn't save as you keep going. You have to save copies of your MXD or your layers and then open it back up and add your new data. So I learned how to do that, and then I can't remember if it was a sergeant or an officer, but somebody came in a few days after the bulletin went out and said, who put out this bulletin? And he pointed to me. And so, and we were in cubicles. So he walked back there. He's like, you really stumbled across something good, because we just found out that two of our apartment complexes were giving these scooters away for free as part of a lease agreement for students coming in, because we're a college town.
Yeah.
And we didn't know about it. And they don't require you to register the scooter. They just basically hand it over. Oh, wow. And so a lot of the students, you know, they had cars or other transportation, or they just, you know, didn't want to ride scooters, I guess.
Yeah.
And so they would just leave them out on the sidewalk or leave them out on their stairs in front of their apartment. And they got stolen, and they were being pushed over fences and all kinds of stuff. And we couldn't figure out where they were going to, but we knew we had a problem. And so he came in and he said, yeah, good job, because now we know where these scooters are coming from. And it continued for months. Like, we were getting, that was the majority, probably 90% of the motor vehicle deaths in Tallahassee and Leon County were these scooters. And it's not a huge deal, because it's not as big of an item as a car, or it's not as expensive as a car, but it drives your calls for service, and it impedes some other service that you could provide quicker to your citizens, because the officers and the deputies are having to go out here and deal with this just because, you know, the free scooters and they weren't locked up. So that's when I figured out that I was good at crime pattern analysis. And I was like, well, maybe, you know what? I said, maybe I chose the right place. And I didn't have a clue what crime analysis was a week ago before I came here.
Yeah.
But I think I'm going to stick with it. And so that's kind of what,
yeah, that's how you cut your
what
teeth,
made
right?
me, yeah.
So were these, when you say scooters, are these like the ones that you rent in cities nowadays where they have the GPS and you put your credit card in and you rent them for an hour
like
or
the
something
Lime
like that?
And stuff.
Yes.
No, these are what we call scooters. There are more the motorized, like mopeds.
The ones you actually sit down
that
on?
That you sit on, yeah.
Wow, that seems so amazing that an apartment complex would give those away.
Yeah.
And not have any way to register them or track them, or didn't even have the foresight to think that they could just be stolen and just cause huge problems.
And I think too, don't quote me, but I want to say they had a total of, in this particular year, this just one complex had a total of 500 that they were going to give away for the new leases. But I could be wrong, could be off by a couple hundred, you never know. But yeah, it was some big number, and we were like, oh wow, so we have to think about 500 potential vehicle deaths for this. But yeah, I mean, yeah, so we actually went out, and I mean the department, to the complexes and spoke with them, and then I believe we had spoken with the complex manager or something about just, you know, advising them, the students, when they get the scooters, to at least put a chain on them and,
sure,
you know, lock them up or on the bike rack or something like that. But yeah,
is that still a program that's still going on today, do you know?
I don't think they're doing it now.
Yeah.
We still have a little bit of scooter thefts every now and then,
sure,
but nothing like that. I mean, we were getting 20 a week. It was... And that was when I was with Tallahassee PD.
Yeah, it's like one of those ideas, like, yeah, it seemed like a good idea at the time, but now, not so much.
Right.
Oh, wow. All right. great. I want to switch gears a little bit now and talk about sovereign citizens, because this is something that you have several publications on. And so let's first just define sovereign citizens, and then we'll get into the topics that you've written about.
So a lot of people, a lot of departments define them a little bit differently. The FBI says they're domestic extremists. Mm-hmm. And so that's basically what they are. Some of them are dangerous, some of them aren't, but they all have the potential to be. The difference is a sovereign citizen by default is just a person with a set of beliefs about the government. Some of them believe that they don't need to pay taxes. Some believe that they're owed more from the government due to the treaty with Morocco, and that's more of the Moorish nation version of the sovereigns. Some of them are biblical-based sovereigns that cite Bible passages from Christian Bible, Hebrew Bible. But the majority of them are just what we call paper terrorists, and that's a common term that's used in all aspects of law enforcement for those who are familiar with sovereigns. And they use that term because they mostly file fraudulent liens and frivolous lawsuits, and a lot of officers have to be aware of them because the sovereigns will actually file these liens against an officer. And I do remember one story where an officer had pulled a sovereign citizen over, and they claim harassment and that they're a free person and they're a free traveler, they don't need a government ID, and I mean just all sorts of claims. And this one officer went to buy a house, I believe, and there was some astronomical lien in the millions against him that affected his ability to buy this house, and it eventually got settled. Mm-hmm. But it was a sovereign who filed this. Yeah. And I don't know what location it was in or what jurisdiction or even what state that wouldn't catch it when mm-hmm. this was filed, but sometimes it just doesn't get caught. And in this particular instance, that's one of the prominent cases of the paper terrorist mm-hmm. version of a sovereign citizen. But they're mostly anti-government domestic extremists.
It's kind of funny that they're anti-government and yet they're using the government for their own advantages.
Right.
And so, you know, what are some tips to identifying sovereign citizens?
So there's a whole bunch of them, and there's new ones coming every day because they just like with criminals and some gang members, some of them get smarter and smarter mm-hmm. and think of new ways to do things. So with your, when you have a traffic stop, there's certain key indicators, like any tag that has some religious references to it, or, and I'm not saying that's all of them, because mm-hmm. some state tags may have like in God We Trust or something like that, but mm-hmm. some passages like that, or any of the Uniform Commercial Code citations, that's a big one that sovereign citizens love to use. Any references to the treaty with Morocco or just Morocco in general. There are some what we call constitutional sovereigns that cite the Constitution a lot, the original Constitution, without the new amendments. There are other instances where you'll see placards with "Don't Tread on Me" and the popular rattlesnake coil. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people use that, and even a lot of stores sell it. But if you see the placard on the window, it's just something, especially for officers when they're out on the street and they're doing a traffic stop or something, it's just something to be aware of that it could be. But you can't say that it's a sovereign 100% just because of that one thing. But there are other indicators like free person, free traveler, that are written on some vehicles. I've seen one that had the "Don't Tread on Me." I've seen it also have the free traveler, I'm a free person, citizen of the land. Mm-hmm. And that was all on this one truck. Mm-hmm. And so we knew right off the bat, we're like, that's indicative of sovereign ideology. But it's not illegal in mm-hmm. itself. So there are other indicators, especially for courtroom personnel, where you might find a red thumbprint. And that's one of their signatures, is when they file their papers, they'll put a red thumbprint on it. They put a lot of gold seals. They put their signature, might have a dash through it, or it might be one letter different, or a lowercase letter instead of an uppercase letter in their name. And they also might cite the UCC codes, and they'll or they'll sign their name and they'll put all rights reserved.
What's UCC?
Uniform Commercial Code.
Okay.
So that's their real law that they consider this, the like the maritime law and all that. They cite that, even though it has no bearing on anything that they're trying to do.
Yeah.
But that's the law they like to go by. And
the red thumbprint, is that signifying done in blood?
So some people say yes.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people believe that the thumbprint is just their way of marking a government document. And in some of them I see they actually mark it with a blue thumbprint or red thumbprint or a black thumbprint.
Uh-huh.
Red is the most popular color, but I tell everybody when I talk to them, I was like, you have fax machines and stuff, they're not all going to be red.
Yeah.
You have to look for any colored thumbprint. And then some people believe that it's because of their straw man identifier. So they have, when they put the hyphen in their name, or when they do the lowercase name, or they put AL, Al Bay or El Bay, mm-hmm. after their name, especially for the Moorish sect, people believe that the thumbprint also signifies the fact that they are signing with their person identifier instead of their like straw man with their social security number and stuff, because they believe separating the two also separates their liability for certain criminal penalties. So they're like, okay, well, this person with this government number did this burglary, or they vandalized this house, but me, I'm a free person. My name is Tommy Smith hyphen L Bay. That I'm a totally different person. I didn't do that. So a lot of people, there's different beliefs as to what they think it signifies. And a lot of the sovereigns now that we see do it because they've seen other people do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really don't know why they do it. and I have a not so much as a theory, but my, and one of my publications is my belief is, I have three ways I classify sovereign citizens. I have a true sovereign, which is the one who really adheres to the ideology and just, I mean, doesn't go to the DMV. They don't get the driver's license, none of that. Then you have the pretenders, which are those that, especially like on a traffic stop, they'll harass the officer and just, you know, go back and forth saying, oh, well, I'm a free person. I'm on free land. I'm a free traveler. I'm traveling. I'm in my property, which is the vehicle. And they'll just argue back and forth with them. Now, but then they'll turn around and they have government documents. They send their kids to public school, which is government funded. And then you have seasonal sovereigns, which do it just for their benefit. And that's the term that I kind of coined, was the seasonal sovereign. And that's the ones that do it sometimes, and sometimes they don't. It just depends on what's going to benefit them
mm-hmm.
at the time. But they have the ideology 1 week, and then the next week they're like a regular person. So most of them, their main goal is just to disrupt the courtroom, disrupt law enforcement, the legal process. And generally they recognize the sheriff as an authority, or his deputies, because they're empowered by the sheriff. In most cases, they don't recognize the authority of a police officer or a shield. It's not a star. And that just goes because the sheriff is quote unquote for the people, and he's elected by the people,
yes.
Whereas police officers are not.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but the majority of them, and I don't know an exact percentage, but the majority of them will probably never be violent. But there is that unknown factor, and that's what a lot of my stuff centers on, is that unknown factor, because there are several that in the few cases that have been out there that were very violent. They killed police officers, and so that's the really the unknown factor is what you have to watch out for. So we can't say that they're any less dangerous than a gang member just because of certain things that we don't know, or just because they haven't done it yet, or we haven't come across the right one.
Yeah, so if someone listening wants to find out more information about sovereign citizens, or wants to even find out if they're sovereign citizens in their jurisdictions, what recommendations would you have?
So a huge one is, and we have a good relationship with our clerk of court, they receive a lot of the court filings, the fraudulent liens and lawsuits, and even affidavits of these people declaring themselves a free person or declaring themselves free of this government name and giving themselves the alias. And so the clerk of court is a real good resource, and especially if you have a clerk or deputy clerk who's trained to recognize the documents, because we have a few that are, and they forward us or forward me the filings. And another good source is the FBI's, I believe it's their, it maybe they're under their counterterrorism section right now, but they have some good publications out there for sovereign citizens, and they update it. I don't know how regularly, but they do update it. And then the SPL, the Southern Poverty League, mm-hmm. is another good one. They publish some stuff on sovereigns a lot. But we're trying to get it more main place, you know, more commonplace for sovereign beings, the sovereign ideology, sovereign indicators to be taught to analysts and law enforcement personnel. Mm-hmm. And a matter of fact, I had somebody reach out from a court marshal's offices, and I think it was in Arkansas, but I can't remember exactly. And he reached out to me a couple of years ago wanting to do, he'd come across my stuff on LinkedIn or maybe one of the online university publications that I did, and wanted to use some of my material to train his marshals in the court for recognizing and dealing with sovereigns, because there's a certain way you have to deal with them. It's not like your gang members where you can go out and you know they're going to be violent, you are expecting it. But sovereigns don't necessarily have to be violent, but they can cause an officer to feel like he needs to be violent because of the way they just irritate him so much. So there's certain ways, and I'm not a behavioral analyst, so I mm-hmm. can't mm-hmm. you know, speculate as to what the best way is, but there's certain things you just can't give in to when they try to goat you and make you mad. And so that's one of the things that I think really needs to be taught, especially to, I mean, even in the law enforcement academies that mm-hmm. might not necessarily have that type of training.
So we'll get some links on the sovereign citizens for our listeners, and we'll make sure they have some links if they want some more information.
Okay.
I'm going to switch gears again and on you, because I got a couple of topics that I do want to focus on before we finish up here. So let's talk about the FCIAA, and we're here at the conference, pretty much wrapped up today. We're at the last day of the conference. Didn't have a conference last year, so yeah. Just how does it feel to be able to get together, have the conference this year after missing it last year?
It feels great. We originally planned for 5 days because we're going to have our new certification courses and then the IACA certification exam hosted on a Monday and a Friday, but we had to still push those off just because of some instructor discrepancies with the scheduling and still with COVID protocols. So, but yeah, it feels great with just our 3 days, and because I haven't traveled since March of 2020. So yeah,
just like everybody
yep.
else.
So it feels good to get out of town for a little bit and actually come together and have a successful conference. And we were so grateful this year that we had a head count that rivaled pretty much all of our other conferences, and
okay,
so it's
great.
Pretty normalized.
Good, and this is my first regional conference, so kudos for you guys, because I had no idea what to expect. It is a little bit smaller, but it's working, and it's definitely some great topics, and it's great to see a more local base, and just it seems like almost every analyst from Florida is here.
Yeah, we have a good number of them. And then, like we even have some state analysts here, and that's something we lack sometimes is the state analysts. But we, Donna, our VP of training, managed to rope some of them in to present for us. So they mm-hmm. also got to sit through some of the courses at the conference. So it was a real nice turnout.
Okay. And then you are technology coordinator for the association.
Yes.
So what exactly are you doing for the association?
So when I first started, I kind of volunteered myself to help out with the website. And so I was website manager, and then my duties kind of expanded because I do like all the technology, including the conference app and the email servicing and everything like that. So it got changed to technical director. And so now I am a board member, not an elected board member, but just one of the appointed board members. And so I deal with everything on a pretty much a daily basis with all the registrations that come in and all of the contact form submissions, any coding problems that we have with the website, the server hosting. And so it's been a learning experience for me, just learning how to do WordPress and coding some of that and scripting some different add-ons to the website in the back end, because I had never worked with WordPress before. I'd worked with other hosting platforms and other website building services, but never WordPress. So it was a huge learning curve, but got the hang of it. And so we've integrated a lot of new services, and we have our new version of a listserv out. We had it server-based before, but because of the speed and the latency with sending server-based emails, we decided to go with the Google Groups. And so now we have a Google Group set up with every new member that joins. And so it serves as a listserv where members can talk back and forth. And then we have our registration set up through the website. We have a website store where we sell our products. And so pretty much everything we do now can be handled through the website, with the exception of our conference maintenance. And that's handled through our new app that we just started using this year. And it has been successful. We've had...
What's the app?
Whova, W-H-O-V-A. And we've had tremendous success with that this year. And so I forget what their average download rate is, but over 85 to 90% of our attendees download the app and have been actively using it.
Yeah, it seems really interactive. I was impressed when I was presenting yesterday, and there's a Q&A section right in there that folks can ask me questions as I'm presenting. So far, so good as far as I'm seeing. So.
Yeah, we've been very happy with it. I don't think we have any complaints at all at this point.
Yeah, although there is a spot to complain.
Yes, yes, there is that.
All right, well, very good. So let's finish up with personal interests, and because yours is unique, and that you have done some modeling and acting.
Yeah.
So let's talk about how you got involved in that.
So it seemed like a different life, but so during high school, I did a little bit of like fashion modeling, because I actually got picked up on MySpace. Here I'm telling my age again, but so MySpace was the thing, and there were a lot of recruiters out there, and I had one, and he sent me a book on acting for the camera and modeling for the camera, and just found me on MySpace and actually mailed me the book, wanted me to fly out to LA. Well, I was a teenager, so I didn't fly out to LA because I was too shy at the time and too scared to go out there, but I ended up doing a little bit of modeling for like a Halloween costume and a little bit of fashion for jeans. And then that was like in a different life. And then I started the government career and the law enforcement in my college. And so after that, I actually was told that there was a lady up in Atlanta that was trying to cast for some TV shows. And so the email got sent to me, and I'm like, well, just give it a try. And it was just calling for an extra. And so I said, well, okay, I'll give it a try, because it'll be an experience, you know, just to be in a TV show. You know, I've never done anything like that before. So I sent the email with the required things and the headshot and everything. And then so I wasn't really expecting anything back, because I figured, you know, Metro Atlanta and then filming all these movies up there now, they had a ton of people applying, and I wouldn't get a call back. But here I go, about a couple hours later, I get a call, and then I get an email with the instructions about coming up for a fitting and then coming for the actual extra part of the thing, where you just basically, as an extra, for those who don't know, you stand around the production set and you just do what they tell you to do. You stand there or you pretend to talk on camera. But I got a call, it was that evening after my initial email, and said, hey, actually, instead of coming up in a few days, can you come up tomorrow? And I said, is it for like a different scene? And she said, oh, the director actually handpicked you and wants you to be a featured part. So I was like, oh yeah, I'll definitely be there tomorrow. So I drove up there, and it was long hours, and it's, I think all of the days that we filmed on every TV show, every movie, was 12 to 15 hour days.
Wow.
And some of it was during winter time, and there's no relaxing. But so the majority of it was basically, I call it just modeling for the camera, because when you're featured, it just means that they want to see your face on the camera. They show you on camera. And then I ended up getting a small part on the Devious Maids series that ended a couple years ago. And that was just about a group of maids that were, quote, devious. And I mean, they
were the title.
Yeah. And they were, I mean, really nice group of ladies that played the parts. And so I actually got a part there where I had to go talk to somebody at the bar. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, of course, for those listening, it wasn't a real bar. It was a stage prop. And it was supposed to be like a hotel bar. And that was on the Devious Maid show. And then I got another one where I was in another bar on the Tyler Perry show, Haves and Have Nots. And that one I had to talk to somebody at the bar too. And that was, I was on screen there with John Schneider from Dukes of Hazzard.
Nice.
And then Tyler was behind the camera directing. So it's been a very interesting experience. And I think the last time that I did anything up there was probably in 2016 or maybe 2017. And it's just been from the transition to the sheriff's office and with the going for the PhD, it's just my schedule has been so full and with FCIAA that I just haven't had time to even look at anything else. And I've gotten a couple calls wanting me to come up. I got a call from the OWN network, and they tried to get me to come up and do some shows for one of the shows on the OWN network, and I just did not have time.
Sure. Yeah, too much FCIA to get the acting career going. So when you were saying that you're talking, is that an actual speaking role, or we would just see you in the background as if you were talking? Do you actually have a speaking role?
So there are a couple different things, and I'm not an expert on all the movie lingo because I haven't done it that much. But so you have your general extras, and you have your feature role, which is basically an extra. It's still not a speaking role, but they may look like they're talking. I mean, even extras can look like they're talking. But the featured role just means that they want to see you closer up, and they want to. It's almost like modeling on screen, and then you have some different levels, and then one of them is called U5L is what one of the terms is, and it means under five lines. And so that's what I ended up doing for one of the shows. And so that one I was actually talking, but you never know when those things happen. You're like, oh yeah, you're gonna see my face on the big silver screen, or I'm gonna be talking for 200 million people. But then the director has his cut, and you might get cut out altogether. And then so they'll have to buy the director's cut if they want to watch it. So there's no telling where you're going to end up.
And when we had the prep call, you mentioned that when you were on the movie Fifth Wave.
Right.
That's what happened, right? You had
A
lot of good parts, but it actually didn't make the cut.
Right. Yeah, that was a very interesting experience. So most of them is a totally different dynamic than when you're filming a TV show, especially in Atlanta, because most of the TV shows up there are filmed local by our, directors that are local, production companies that assist. The movies, some of them, especially the big blockbusters, are people that are from California. And so that's what the Fifth Wave was. So it's a whole different dynamic and working with each kind of person, because it's a different world out there. And then that one was so long. It was filmed in the winter months in Atlanta in 2014, and it was sleeting and almost snowing, and it was raining. It was cold. It was 20-something degrees, and most of it was filmed outside in the rain. But there were some cool scenes. We had a helicopter fly overhead to actually bank and blow fog away so the cameras could see us. And I know that had to be a very expensive scene just to keep that helicopter up in the air that much.
Yeah.
For all the takes, but because it's retake after retake. But yeah, that one ended up, we did a lot of stuff, and we had a lot of good storyline. And then once the director's cut hit, me and included, but a lot of people in the group felt that the cut was just too much and it took away from the storyline. And it did cut most of our scenes.
So our last segment to the show is Words to the World. And so this is where I give the guests the last word. And Tommy, you can promote any idea that you wish, but what are your words to the world?
So my biggest thing right now is don't be afraid to get out of your comfort zone. Because I wasn't comfortable when I was in the room with all these strange people on a TV screen in front of a camera under a hot heat lamp. And this was not crime analysis, this was not law enforcement, this was not education, which is something I've always been good at, studying and writing. And so I was totally out of my comfort zone, like with the whole modeling thing and everything. That's just something you have to stand there and look, but actually acting something out. And that was totally new to me, but I ended up doing it, and I liked it. And then, so I got my name out there, and then even with crime analysis profession, sending stuff out on the International Association's listserv, just getting your name out there, that's the only way that you are going to be successful if you truly want to make crime analysis or intelligence analysis a career and not a job. And that's where a lot of people get confused. They think because they're a crime analyst, that's their career. But if you don't get out there, you're not going to have a career. It's just going to be another job for you. And that's where I quickly found out that networking can help you there. Because if I hadn't have networked and I hadn't got out there, I wouldn't be at the sheriff's office, and I wouldn't have been recruited to the sheriff's office. So I've had a couple people ask, even in the app this year for the conference, about, you know, moving to Florida, what it's going to take to get a job as a Florida analyst. Well, that's what it takes. Even though you've been an analyst out of state, there are people that can put in good words for you if they know who you are. There's people that can attest to your character at different agencies that you've networked with at these international conferences, but they can't if you don't speak to them. So that's what's important, is just to get out there and put your name out there.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with, you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later. But I do appreciate you being on the show, Tommy. Thank you so much, and it's great to see you in person. And you be
too.
Safe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Elder, and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.